Hey, listeners, this is your host, Abir Sichter. This episode of Local Global Leaders is titled, I Have Lived the American Dream. I had the privilege of sitting down with Michael Adams, the Secretary of State of Kentucky. Secretary Adams shares his journey growing up in a working-class Kentucky family while witnessing shifts in our political system and even the way the two parties are seen by Americans. And we talked about how those experiences throughout his life have shaped his commitment to expanding access to the American dream and to growing profound democratic engagement. We also discussed his pragmatic approach to governing, how he rejects extreme partisan politics, his civic-centered philosophy of leadership, and how the evolving landscape of media and technology and new modes of communication are influencing our republic. We also bonded over our shared ties as we both graduated from the McConnell Scholars Program at the University of Louisville, though from different generations. Now, here's our conversation. Greetings, listeners. I'm here today in the Secretary of State Michael Adams' office here in Frankfurt. Secretary Adams, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Was really excited to get to interview a state leader and a fellow McConnell Scholar from the University of Louisville. I don't know if you remember, this would have been summer 2010, my freshman year, when the McConnell Scholars do our D.C. orientation. I think we got to meet you there very briefly. I believe you were working as a lawyer there, or maybe a lobbyist at the time.
I think it was the RGA at the time.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
But really, really great to meet you then and to obviously talk with your Secretary of State. Just such a great honor.
I graduated in a different millennium than you did. So I had a much different experience than you did. I had a wonderful experience, but I guarantee you yours was much better. After I graduated in the 20th century, they had a lot more funding, a lot more opportunity. Mm-hmm. Did you get to go to China?
Yes, yep.
I didn't get to go to China, but I'm glad for you. I'm sure it was a wonderful experience.
Thank you. Yeah, the McConnell program is so great and get to network with great leaders like yourself because of it.
Thank you.
I really appreciate that. But my first question I was going to start out with is what I call your six-word story. What are six words you'd use to describe yourself?
I have lived the American dream. Only get six words, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's going to be a short program.
Yeah. And what else do you want listeners to know about, how you are as a leader, and what do you want us to know about you off the bat, about how you came to where you are?
You know, I think the reason I've connected with Kentuckians is most of us are people who grew up working class and have made our way and ultimately found success as we define it. And, historically, especially in the Democratic Party, we've had a lot of wealthy people run for office or prestigious families with a long political lineage. And the Republican Party is a little bit more work your way up. We don't really have dynasties the way the Democrats do. And I think there's some appeal to that. I think the average Kentuckian kind of likes that. You're seeing a move away from political dynasties in both parties nationally. But here in the state, you're really seeing people who work their way up from nothing become successful in politics and other things, too. But I think especially at a time you've seen a big realignment politically, the Republican Party is now the party of the working class. When I was a boy, it was the Democratic Party. My family, my dad was a union member, right? And my family voted Democratic, and they were registered Democrats. And now that the GOP is the working class party, you're seeing more working class people come up through the ranks politically like I did as Republicans.
Wow. So it sounds like, your vision of the American dream and how you came to a different political view in a sense from that previous generation, that all ties really well together.
Well, the American dream is basically if you work hard and you think hard, you can succeed and you can be whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And my parents taught me that and my grandparents taught me that. And it's true. That's not to say that there aren't obstacles that you don't have to work to overcome. It doesn't mean that the government can't do a much better job than it does of ensuring that there's opportunity. But if you look for it, it's there. We give everyone a free education. And now increasingly you even see colleges giving free education. Mm-hmm. Harvard now, if your parents make under $200,000, you get a big scholarship. And if they make only $100,000, you go to Harvard for free. I would have killed for that back in the day. But you are seeing much more attentiveness to the needs of people in the educational system. And of course, the two parties differ about how to address this. Mm-hmm. But I hope that we keep having that conversation, that debate about how do we improve opportunity. Because I'm worried about the next generation, that they won't have it like I did, where I could come up from nothing and be successful.
Wow. And can you tell us more about what motivated you to be a leader in the community, in particular to run for elected office?
Well, in a literal sense, I wasn't a community leader. I lived in Louisville, but I was on a plane every week to D.C., practicing law there and then flying home on the weekends and living in Louisville. And one of the reasons I chose to run statewide and not locally is I thought that if I ran locally, it would be about what organization do you belong to, where'd your kid go to school, things like that. If I ran statewide, it would be more about issues, which it certainly was. This is not a pro me statement, it's just an observation. I was the first candidate to run for Secretary of State on an election law and election policy platform. This office is the chief election official, among other things, but no one else had ever done that before. The election issues were not sexy, elections were boring. And so it's no surprise that my predecessors, from Trey Grayson to Allison Grimes, and John Y. Brown before them, they really ran more on the business side of the office. And if you go back and look, each of them was 31 years old when elected. Mm-hmm. They were very young junior corporate attorneys at big law firms, right? And their special sauce was talking about the business side of the office, which we do. But I was different. I had a career in election law that I built nationally from scratch. And that's the subject matter that I knew, mm-hmm. that I was comfortable with, where I thought I was more knowledgeable than my opponent, who had other strengths that I didn't have. And so the way I was successful in my campaign was to make the election referendum on election issues versus other ones, or the personalities of the candidates, or the fact that she was Miss America and I was not, I was going to lose that one. So when you run statewide, it's really not about community as much. It's really more about the issue set that you have.
I like how you said, yeah, like your predecessors had more experience in that sort of corporate business realm. I've read that you've described your role as being like in the customer service business, more on that end. So
I think everybody in the executive branch is in the customer service business. Hmm. And I think that's one big difference between the legislature and the executive branch. And again, it's not a value proposition. It's just the way the system is set up, where their job is to take positions on all sorts of divisive issues. Their job is to argue with the other side, right? There is no other side where I am. My job is to run the department. My job is to make sure voters get to vote. My job is to make sure the businesses get registered when they come in and register. And so it, just by nature, the executive branch is less ideological and more pragmatic and more practical, because it has to be, because I don't vote on stuff. I don't vote yes or no 100 times a week like a legislator does. It's just a different job. They have a job to do, and I applaud their job. It's just a different job here.
And you, I mean, and you've worked with people in both legislative and executive branches, working for Senator Mitch McConnell, Governor Ernie Fletcher, President George W. Bush. How did they influence you and inspire your journey to where you are?
You know, one memory I had of working for Governor Fletcher was just kind of how exasperated he got sometimes with politics, because he wasn't a politician. And I guess anyone who runs for office is a politician, but he had only been in elected office, I think, for 5 years when he was elected governor. He'd just mm-hmm. been in Congress a couple terms. And he was a normal person, unlike politicians. He was a doctor. He was a lay minister. He was a fighter pilot in the Air Force. And so politics was a thing that he learned late in life, and he got very frustrated with it. Working for McConnell was a different experience, because McConnell's entire career was politics. Mm-hmm. There might have been a year or two where he was out of a job in politics because his side lost and he had to go bill hours or something. But for 40 years, right, he's been in elected office continuously, longer than that, almost 50. And so I never saw that with him. You know, certainly there's a lot of frustration in politics at any level. But I really never saw that from him, just because he always found a way to move the ball. And by having been in office so long and having been a staffer before that, he had a great deal more patience. And so this job has really taught me patience. I'd like to think I had some patience already just from having been a staffer before I ever ran for office.
Okay. And what have been like some of the most unexpected or biggest challenges in your leadership journey, whether as Secretary of State or in prior roles?
The biggest challenge was COVID. It's a challenge for everybody. It was a special challenge for me because I ran in 2019 in part on opposing my opponent's plan to move to a mail-based voting system, where we would just automatically mail people ballots versus having voting days like we have, which I thought was a terrible idea. And making the election referendum on issues like that is how I came from 15 points down and defeated her. And then I get sworn in, and then 2 months later, I've got to recant everything I said. I normally don't believe in voting by mail as the best way to vote, but in a pandemic, especially folks don't remember, those first few months, we had no idea what caused it. We had no idea how it transmitted. Mm-hmm. I remember walking down the hall with the governor to our press conference where we announced our plan, and he scolded me for wearing a necktie. He told me that dry cleaning spread COVID. That's total nonsense. But we didn't know. We didn't know that dry cleaning didn't cause COVID. No one knew what. Yeah. There was no masking. There was no nothing in the spring of 2020. We knew nothing. All we knew is that we didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. But we knew that people gathering by the millions in person was going to be fatal to many, many people, because we'd already seen other states vote and people died mm-hmm. because they went and stood in line to go vote. Voting was literally lethal, and we weren't going to do that here. And the hard part for me, of course, was to flip on a dime and say, well, I know I said all that stuff about not voting in, voting by mail, but this is different. And we did a flash poll, or I got a flash poll right after that, that showed that 2 out of 3 Republicans disapproved of my performance. I'd just been sworn in 3 months before, and already they were ready to throw me out of office. So I had to find a way to help Kentuckians survive the virus, but also for me to survive making a hard decision. And it could have been tougher because Beshear was the bete noir now of the GOP. They really disliked him, and he's given them plenty of reason to. And then here I am being the one Republican in the entire city who works with him and is seen on camera doing that. So I had a lot of things cutting against me. But here's the pleasant surprise. And I still don't fully believe this, but I know it's true because I saw it. At a time that we had the sitting president of the U.S. at the time saying, don't vote by mail, it's rigged. Don't vote early, it's rigged. Wait till election day and show up in person. Voters were getting that every day, and specifically Republicans were getting it every day and believing it. And then you had this new guy people barely knew just come to town telling people, I know he said that, but you should vote by mail and you should vote early. And we're going to give you weeks to vote early that you never had before. And we're going to give you absentee ballots and all this other stuff. And I'm still shocked, but it's true that people listen to me instead of him. And specifically, Republicans listen to me instead of him. Mm-hmm. And in our 2020 primary election, we went from, in April, 2 out of 3 Republicans hating my guts to in June, 2 months later, 60% of Republicans who voted by absentee ballot. And then a lot more voted early, too. So I'm shocked that people listen to me, and they listen to me and someone else who disagreed, and they followed my advice against all they were getting on cable news and from the White House and so forth. So what that taught me is if you stake a lonely stand and you go out there with facts and explain why you're right and you're patient and you're not condescending and you just explain, here are the facts, here's why we're doing this, here's why you can trust it. You have to communicate constantly, all day, every day, through every medium you can find. But if you make that case and you're consistent and you're earnest and your facts are legitimate, people will listen. And the great surprise is not just that that we were able to do it and we had the legislature allow us to do it. We had to get the voters to actually do the things we wanted them to do. Mm-hmm. You can legalize all this stuff, right? This will mean people will actually take advantage of it and utilize it. So it wasn't just getting grace from the legislature to make all these changes. It was getting voters to believe in them and actually change their own behavior. It is very, very hard today to get anyone to change one's mind or one's behavior. And people are very suspicious of anyone who tries to get them to do that. So it's a modern marvel that in this era of high polarization, with the stakes as high as they were, that we were successful. And And part of that was that I learned, fortunately, in 30 years of being in politics, how to communicate, how to message, and how to give people an argument, an explanation that fit what they found persuasive, not what I would find persuasive. Let me give you an example. When I was in law school, I had a debate. I was head of the Harvard Law School Republicans, and we had a presidential debate in the year 2000 when I was there. And one of the things we debated was the estate tax. And so I knew what my audience was going to be like, left-leaning young people. So I didn't make an argument about the estate tax from a free market perspective. I made it from an environmentalist perspective, that the estate tax requires the sale of family farms for industrial purposes because people can't pay the taxes. They got to sell the farm, right? No, I didn't win the debate, but I got a hearing I would never have gotten if I'd just gone up there and made the typical argument. I made a lot of arguments I didn't find persuasive at all, but I knew that the people hearing them would find them persuasive. And I used that for other things I did. So, for example, when I needed poll workers, if I was talking to a more Democratic constituency, I would say, help us save democracy, right? You got to volunteer, help us run this election, be a poll worker, fight voter suppression. If I was talking to a more right-leaning audience or a Republican-type audience, I'd say, if you want to get away from this vote-by-mail business, we got to open these polls up. So volunteer to be a poll worker. Those are the same statement, the same ask, but different pitches with different biases built in. You have to understand the biases of your audience, but you also have to hope that they're capable of getting to the facts through you and then changing their mind or their behavior. And people will still do that if you make a good, credible case.
I think that that relates really well to what you were saying at the beginning about how, you know, how both Democrats and Republicans have like some working class appeal that's kind of changed, but also to your views of like being a pragmatic executive leader and like, you know, adapting from mail-in voting to making different arguments. What would you say, like, based on all that, is your overall leadership style or philosophy?
Empathy. And that's kind of a word that's out of style right now. People see empathy as a weakness. They see it as lacking conviction or strength or something. I don't think it is. I think it is a great strength. I think having the willingness to hear someone else and to take another perspective and be willing to second guess your own perspective takes a lot of guts. So I read a book a few years ago, and candidly, I don't recall the name, but the author of the book was Dick Morris, who was Bill Clinton's top political advisor in the 90s. And I'm paraphrasing slightly, but not very much. The first line of his book is, he said, in 25 years, America will have transitioned away from a Madisonian democracy in which we elect people of virtue and integrity and we trust them to make decisions on our behalf to a Jeffersonian or Jacksonian democracy where people will have very little patience for any filter between their views and results. There's a lot less deference to public servants today. And it's not just politicians. It's teachers, it's nurses, anyone who deals with the public. You're always being suspected and second-guessed, like you have some sort of hidden agenda or something. So the internet is largely responsible for this. People think they know more than they actually do because they Google it and there's content, right? So now I know as much as the guy who's in Frankfurt, right? So it's really, really tricky to try to find ways to reach people and persuade people. And in my office in particular, I have no power. I can't do anything. I had emergency powers briefly that I asked for and got that have expired appropriately because there's no emergency now. But I don't have power to just do stuff. The legislature writes the laws. They appropriate the money. I have no power. I can stamp stuff. I can sign stuff. That's all I can do. The only power I have is the power of persuasion. In an era when you have people less open to persuasion, you have a smaller political center, and you have people's habits just not being as open-minded, it just makes it really hard to govern in this time. I think any other person in politics would tell you the same thing, that governing right now is really hard.
But it sounds like with your leadership style and philosophy centering around empathy, you kind of prefer to lead more with your heart than like with your head maybe? Or?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No, I'm a hard rationalist, and politics by its nature is very emotional. Especially in a primary, the turnout in a November election is kind of like clockwork. It's election day, right? In a primary, people don't always know when the election is. It's a tiny turnout. It's really about who can motivate people the most. So I say that because there's a built-in tension between being a rational public official and making decisions based on facts. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in COVID, deciding we're going to have absentee ballots, we're going to have to open the polls for more than one day. We got to open them for weeks to get people in without having crowds. Those are rational decisions, but people react to them very emotionally, mm-hmm. and you have to try to pre-guess what the emotional reactions are going to be to fact-based decisions that are just, to me, pretty obvious ones, just, you know, pretty apparent from the state of play. So, no, I don't think empathy is being emotional. Really, it's being like an attorney, right? You train as an attorney to be able to argue the other side's case as well as your own. And so that's really more of a mental skill than it is an emotional reaction.
I think that's interesting to put it. I hadn't thought of that with empathy. I'm a fellow lawyer too, went to law school, but never thought of obviously try to understand the other side's view, but never thought of that as like empathy, I guess. So I appreciate that perspective.
Yeah. It's not being a bleeding heart. Mm. It's being someone who can see every side of an angle, think it through well in advance, think about what the responses are going to be to what you want to do, positive and negative. And most responses to most things are negative in politics. Animal welfare is an issue that's important to me, and I've been out there trying to help on this front. And it's frustrating because it's a 95-5 issue. But the 5% who want to block reform tend to be pretty effective, beating the 95% who want to have better treatment of animals. And the reason is because the 95 are apathetic. They're like, well, of course everyone thinks that. Why should I have to do anything? So not to pick on somebody, but I was in Boone County a month ago speaking about civic education. And this is another issue. It's a 90-10 issue. People want their kids to know the most basic facts about the government. They want them to be informed voters. They want them to know how many branches of government that we have, which they don't. Adults don't know that either. People have an appalling lack of understanding of how the government works. And that only hurts them. It just makes them less effective holding people like me accountable. I want them to hold us accountable. So I was speaking on civic education, and this lady in the audience raised her hand and said, I agree with you. I hope you're successful getting this legislation passed. So when the event was over, I went back down to my table, and she came up to me and shook my hand and said, let me know what I can do. I said, well, if you would call or email your legislators and tell them to vote for our bill, I'd really appreciate it. And she looked at me kind of funny and shook her head and walked off. If you're not willing to send an email, there's not much I can do to help you, right? The people who are angry are the ones who send emails and make calls. Mm. So there's a built-in anti-change movement at any given time. It's extremely rare to see anyone lift a finger in favor of something, right? Unless it's in favor of stopping something they don't like. So I think that's part of why Kentucky has been so slow to reform on so many fronts. It's a frustration to me. There's no way that we would have had all these improvements to our election system if we had not had a crisis that enabled me to act and then people to see that they liked what I did and wanted to keep it. That was very, very helpful. So the great challenge for people like me is to find a way to get people to care enough about improving education, solving the housing crisis, et cetera, where the people who want it will be at least as active as the people who don't want it.
Hmm. And I have my own philosophy of leadership, three simple M's. I call my M's the three M's of leadership: being an effective motivator, a competent manager, and a supportive mentor. So like motivation, management, and mentorship. How do you sort of balance those three roles? And do you see them as like three separate distinct things, or are they all like tied together in your leadership?
So I think the word leadership is way overused. Anytime people see something that they like, oh yeah, that's leadership. Leadership is a very specific thing. Leadership is getting other people to do something. And whenever you see someone say, this person made these tough calls all by himself, all by herself, right? That's not leadership. It's literally a failure of leadership. Leadership is literally getting people to join with you and support what you're doing and help you do whatever that is. I read a lot of books on leadership after I got elected. And they were all garbage. I should write one too. Like, people make money off them, but they're garbage. Leadership is literally finding ways to to get people to be motivated. And leadership is a value-neutral term. There are bad leaders, too. Hitler was a leader. Stalin was a leader, right? So the word leadership is almost meaningless. As a just as a moral position, it's meaningless. There's good and bad leadership. There's demagoguery. That's a form of leadership. So for me, leadership is how can I find out what the right thing is to do, and how can I get people to allow me to do it? And I'm pleased that I've been successful. But again, I have to tip my hat to COVID-19, because if it had not been for that, I don't think I would have been able to accomplish much. But I also think that political savvy helped me accomplish a lot, because I knew how to take advantage of it when it came. Part of what I did, you know, people forget now, but the first thing I did in office was write and pass a photo ID to vote law, which, you know, number one, that was kind of a polarizing issue. And number two, going into COVID with the government shut down and the offices where you get IDs having very limited hours, that was seen as an extremist act on my part. But I did it anyway. And I did it because if I hadn't done it, I would have had no credibility to expand voting options, to have early voting, to have absentee ballots, all the other stuff I wanted. So the stuff that I wanted that was seen as more centrist or center left, I couldn't get it unless I was hard right Genghis Khan on photo ID to vote, because it gave me the street cred with the Republican base. So if I hadn't been so tough on photo ID, I never would have had the ability, number one, to get emergency powers from the legislature. They wouldn't have trusted me. I could have fixed any problems. And number two, I wouldn't have the grace with the voters, especially the Republican base, where they would allow me to experiment and then ultimately take part in the experiment that I was offering of early voting and absentee voting. So I would say that when politicians do stuff that seems dumb or stupid or even harsh, think it through before you judge them. They might have an angle that you could be missing. And that's kind of how I got away with saving the election, was doing that first.
And I guess with your like success in your role, you do think about on balance, like, you know, being a statewide public official, but also trying to be a, you know, a leader or have a role in the Republican Party as well. Like, you have to, like, is it tough to kind of balance both those roles?
Yeah, it's really tough. You know, right now there's been a shift in politics nationally where the notion of state leaders and local leaders in politics is kind of dropping off. The parties are so branded nationally that there's not as much oxygen left for the development of new talent and a new bench and new people, new personalities. Routinely, I will go to Republican Party events and the leaders of the parties don't know who I am. I've won 2 statewide elections. like, how could you not know who the Secretary of State is? It's not picking on me. They don't know who the AG is either, or the treasurer or the auditor. They don't know the most basic things about the people who serve them in their own government. They know who a member of Congress is from Texas or Arizona or Georgia, because they get their news from their phones and from cable news. So there's been really a collapse of jurisdictional lines in how people think about politics. You may have seen on November 4th, I had to tweet out a clarification to Kentuckians that we weren't voting that day. Other states were voting, a few. Most were not. We were not. But we had people showing up the polls to vote and being angry they weren't open. I know of at least one county clerk who got yelled at because someone in her county tried to vote against Mom Donnie for mayor of New York, and she wouldn't let him because we're not part of New York. People just see images and personalities, and they don't really necessarily sort through that's another state. They don't think, well, you know, I'm watching a national news show and they're covering the one election that's going on, right? Mm-hmm. They just don't think that through very well. So it makes it really hard to be a leader in a party at the state level generally. There's just less interest in other people and other issues. So that's part of it. But also part of it is just the nature of politics. The party base just wants people to come in and attack people in the other party, which, you know, I like to make jokes, like I'll do that too, but that's not really how I lead in my official capacity. I don't tweet hate all day from people. I really try to find common ground when I can and govern like an adult. And unfortunately, the incentives are there where people in your party actually like you less if you govern that way. I think the governor probably gets some of this too. I can only speculate, but both parties are getting more polarized and they're getting more negative and nasty, and they want to just attack the other side, attack them in every respect, call them crooks, call them demons or whatever, dehumanize them completely. And there's just less of an appetite for grown-ups in politics, I think, on both sides right now.
And you mentioned earlier, like, you know, being an effective leader means encouraging people, motivating people to do things. Like, how do you kind of try to empower the people who work with and work for you?
Well, I have a very small staff, and most of the persuasion I have to undertake is the legislators. So I do a lot of outreach to them. I try to keep them informed of things that I'm doing. I try to be involved in things that they're doing that could touch on my office. I work with the county clerks really closely of both parties. And one of the nice things about the county clerks is their office is a lot like mine. And I had to go through a directory to try to figure out which ones were Democrats and which ones were Republicans, because it wasn't obvious, because they don't talk like Democrats and Republicans. They don't attack other people. They don't say kooky things, right? They just show up like professionals and do their job. So it's kind of nice that I can connect with them, because our jobs are very similar. I have to be an adult too. I'm responsible for the elections, just like they are at the local level. So empathy there is really important, knowing what's going on in their community. They actually have an advantage over me in that they govern in Paducah or Mayfield, right, or Somerset or wherever every day. And they don't just make decisions and then go home to some other city. They live and work in their tiny little towns, and they get feedback in a way that I don't. If someone in Somerset doesn't like what I do, I wouldn't know unless they call me and tell me or tweet at me or something. But folks who are county clerks, they go to work in the courthouse in Paducah or Somerset, and then they come out, and then they go to Kroger or they go to church or they go wherever, and they get feedback immediately, right? I get some of that, but not like they do. And that's a big advantage to their position, is they get real-time feedback from constituents on their performance in a way that I just don't. It's absurd that people like me have to spend tens of thousands of dollars to do polling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing I think the regular public don't understand is we don't poll to find out what we believe. I know what I believe. I don't need a poll to tell me that. I poll to find out what people think about what I believe and how I can maybe get them to change their mind, right? But I have to spend money to do that, because people don't just tell me. And that's another frustration, is I wish that regular people would more freely communicate with office holders. Going back to that lady in Boone County, I want her to tell me what she thinks. And it shouldn't just take me going to her county and speaking at her event, right? Like, tell us. We really want to know. Because if you don't communicate with us as the general public, all that space gets filled up with special interests. And all you ever hear from is the people whose views are not representative of the general public, but they're the ones who are organized, right? It's the squeaky wheel syndrome, if you will.
And, you know, you've been recognized, I mean, here in the state and nationally, for your pragmatic leadership during the pandemic, and you've talked about that a lot. And that led to you, a large reason for you winning, I know, the 2024 JFK Profile and Courage Award. And I think Governing Magazine last month recognized you as a public official of the year. I just wanted to, you know, like, what do these awards mean to you, and how does it feel to win those?
So I was asked that by Bill Bryant. I made kind of a self-deprecating remark that there's a scripture where Jesus says a prophet is not without honor except in his own country. And that's kind of how it feels sometimes. When I get honored, it's usually people who don't live here. People in Massachusetts think I'm doing a great job, right? Or people in Washington. It's very flattering, and I've got those two awards sitting right here next to you on my desk. But what I really care about is what do people who live here think, because they're the ones who actually deal with my decisions and my ideas. And I want to know that they think as well of me as people who see me in a news article out of state.
And how do you sort of view and internalize, like, global identity and global citizenship in your work? And how to, like, how is what's happening around the world affect you as a leader here in Kentucky?
Well, I wouldn't go in for global citizenship necessarily, but I would say this. I was in Germany for a week a couple of months ago, and I met with members of parliament. I met with state legislators, or the equivalent. I met with federal legislators. I met with election officials who are not politicians. They're bureaucrats. And they all had the same concern, which is that in 10, 15 years, German politics will look like American politics. And they're very nervous about that. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Latin American politics or Eastern European politics, American politics today looks like they looked 10 years before we'd look that way. So what you're seeing in these changes, so, you know, when I grew up, politics was really dull. we had a huge political center. You routinely saw big landslides in elections one way or the other, right? It wasn't as nasty. It was a little nasty. It's always been a little that way, but it wasn't like it is now. And it changed real, real fast. But this is not unique to America. There is no American exceptionalism on this. These trends are happening everywhere. And it's the nature of a fragmentation of one's media one consumes. It's a function of people having the capital now that they didn't used to have, or now they can live in a place that is culturally more like them, where they feel more comfortable. You have a lot of people leaving blue states, moving to red states, and vice versa. You always have, but it's more so now. I think 14% of Americans move every year. People are self-sorting into communities, and then the communities become more extreme because there's an echo chamber, right? So these phenomena are happening all over the globe. And so when the Germans were telling me, you know, we're nervous that we're going to get more polarized and angry and violent like you all, I kind of wanted to say, well, yeah, but, you know, it wasn't us first, right? It was Brazil and Argentina and Hungary. So these are global challenges in the sense of, you know, the way people react to technology, those things are not uniquely American. They're happening everywhere. So if you want to predict where politics goes, then first predict what communication looks like. So politics used to be very, very local in America for, I don't know, the first 50 years or 75 years that we were a country. And the reason the framers of our Constitution designed it the way that they did was they thought, well, you know, we just left England. We didn't like being governed by someone thousands of miles away who doesn't understand facts on the ground here in Boston or Jamestown. Enough of that. We're going to have a federal system where we're going to have a Congress they're going to come together a few months a year, right? But otherwise, all the decision-making will be done at the state level and the local level. We'll have town meetings in New England, right? We'll have whatever. Local democracy was what they wanted and what they thought just made sense, because look at what they had as an alternative that they were coming from. And that system worked really well until the invention of the telegraph. And then the telegraph meant that the information people received had no jurisdictional tie to them. So if a newspaper just wrote articles about what was going on in the community, now it was writing about the royal family or whatever was going on in some other part of the world, right? It began to, again, narrow jurisdictional lines. Well, the nature of communications today, it's so cheap. There's just no barrier to entry now to communicate. And some of the most influential people in communication are people who just have nothing but a microphone and a YouTube channel that costs virtually nothing. And they can build followerships of millions upon millions of people who have way more relevance in the world than, you know, many members of Congress or governors or what have you. So this is a global phenomenon. It's happening everywhere. And the question is, when does that stop and when does it get replaced by a newer model? We had a more political model of communication for a long time. We had the only people that had the resources to have a newspaper were the Federalists and the Republicans in the days of Adams and Jefferson and Hamilton, right? There were not independent newspapers or independent journalism. It was just this rag or that rag on the other side, and people were very polarized. And then you had the development of a mass market consumerism. You had the Sears Roebuck catalog, and you had, thanks to free enterprise, the need to buy advertising. And then that made possible the creation of independent newspapers. And 90% of the revenue came from advertising, right? Maybe 10-15% from subscribers. I know that model has been destroyed, but it's just a matter of time before some new development that I can't predict, maybe you can, but something will change again that then brings us together more. Radio was what did that. Radio, and then for a while TV. You only had a few radio stations, right? So instead of reading competing political newspapers, people listen to the same radio program, right? That's how we managed to find unity in the first two world wars, because we had the radio and then we had television to kind of bring us together. Everyone listened to the president at the same time. Now the president of the United States speaking is just one more channel out of 500 channels you have on DirecTV, right, or on your phone.
I know you mentioned earlier that most of the leadership books you read are kind of in garbage, but are there any good leadership lessons from any books or publications you want to shout out?
So my leadership lessons, I'm a child of the 20th century. I was born in 76, and I grew up reading bios of Reagan and Nixon and FDR and people like that. Lyndon Johnson. I would read, if I wanted to go into politics today, I'd read those books to kind of better understand how people managed to win those positions, but also to get the public and the Congress to do stuff that they wanted. And they have much different stories. I found reading biographies as a kid really influential and really helpful to me. And I have in my deep subconscious memories of ways that politicians got things accomplished that I don't even know that I have, but they influence decisions that I make. Because in politics, you don't have time to think or poll. You just have to act in real time. And you have to be trained instinctively to make good decisions that are good political decisions, not just simple, bloodless, fact-based decisions, but how do I sell this? And the number one part of the job here is sales. It really is. Other books I routinely recommend. The Death of Expertise is a really, really great book about the phenomenon I talked about where people think they know more than they do. There's less deference to people who do know more in their fields, right? We're now getting information from influencers versus actual experts in fields, and sometimes they're right, but usually they're not. And so that's a really good book. The Big Sort, that's a book, it's not new, it's 15 years old, talking about people relocating, and now you have fewer competitive districts, right? Fewer competitive swing states. You've got deep blue areas and deep red areas, and their reality is totally different. And that's part of why it's so hard for Americans to agree on the same set of facts, because they don't see the same reality. They live in kind of a echo chamber.
And are there any pop culture sources, whether from movies and films, television, or even celebrities or music, that have given you great insights on leadership?
No. Sorry. Absolutely not.
Awesome. And then my last question, we start this interview with your six-word story. What would you say is your six-word legacy? What are six words you want people to envision about you when they think about your impact on Kentucky and the world?
Well, hopefully I'm not dead yet. Hopefully I have a legacy after the legacy in this office. Easy to vote, hard to cheat, I think, is my legacy for this office. But hopefully I'll have another fresher legacy down the road.
Awesome. And do you have any plans for your political future past this
point? I have no announcement at this time.
Awesome. Well, Secretary of State, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview.
Pleasure.
That wraps up my conversation with Secretary Michael Adams. I appreciate his honesty about how governing through challenging times required him to adapt a lot of his views. And he has a commitment to building a legacy that extends far beyond any single office. And he has had great success in making it easier for Kentuckians to vote and be a part of our democracy. My next episode drops in February, and it features Nicholas Hazlett, a Morehead State University student who is serving as city council member for Paintsville, Kentucky, where I grew up. Until then, remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.